Hey, folks, and welcome to Movie Crush. This is Chuck Bryant here in our home studio at Pond City Market. And today, my old pal John Hodgman is on the show. And this was a fun interview. John and I met about 8 years ago when he sent an email to Stuff You Should Know that said, "Guys, I'm a fan. I'm a listener. This is John Hodgman. I know you're coming to New York City. Would you like to have lunch with me and Wyatt Cenac of The Daily Show?" Because Wyatt turned me on to your show. And quite literally, that email kind of changed my life in many ways. We did have lunch with Ian Wyatt, and it was our first sort of celebrity encounter with people who listened to the show. And it was very early on in the days of Stuff You Should Know. And since then, John has been a good pal and a mentor in many ways, even though I'm like 4 months older than him, which is a little weird to have a mentor that's younger than you. But John's an awesome dude and a very kind, generous person, and everyone should know that. And he came in to talk about the Avengers, Marvel's The Avengers, the original Avengers movie, while he came through town on his book tour for his great, 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 great new book, Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. It's really fantastic. I read it, and it's a creative leap forward for Hodgman, and just a very warm, funny, endearing book of essays about him and his real life. No more fake facts and no more deranged millionaire character. This is Hodgman actual, laying it all out there about his life. And his live Vacation Land show was great. And this new book is fantastic. So I urge you to buy it. Make a great Christmas gift for folks. So here we go with John Kellogg Hodgman and the Avengers.
The best thing about Escape from New York, this is not the movie we're talking about.
No, but we can talk about all kinds of movies.
Escape from New York is one of the movies that is in a very specific genre of contemporary apocalyptic New York City.
Yeah.
And another one would be The Warriors, of course.
Yeah.
A fantasy film.
Uh-huh.
Because guess what? There aren't crazy gangs wearing baseball outfits,
yeah,
and clown makeup.
It's too bad.
In Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And also, by the way, guess what gangs aren't? Interracial.
Yeah, that's a good point too.
Coney Island Warriors.
Yeah.
You know, you have your Latinos and your white dudes and your black guys.
Uh-huh. They had all the bases covered.
Yeah. That's an amazing – that's what makes the Warriors so special, I suppose.
Yeah.
The fact that the Gramercy Park Riffs were so cool, but it was, you know, all black – martial arts gang,
yeah,
in Gramercy Park, one of the toniest, the only private park in,
right,
New York City.
No, they had keys.
Yeah, and even then, in New York City, there was wealth around Gramercy Park.
Right.
But those movies only worked because there was the popular conception coming out of the bankruptcy of New York City in the 70s that it,
right,
was a lawless land that was going to go – it was going to go – you know, just going there, you were going to,
uh-huh,
die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there was something to that. I mean, even in the late 80s, early 90s,
sure,
when I would take the train from Yale University, where I was educated, into the city,
mm-hmm,
and then go over the shuttle and go to Penn Station, I was on a trip. My gang and I were stranded at Yale, and I had to get back to Coney Island.
The Yale Toughies?
Yeah, exactly. The Yale Toughies. The Yale Whiffenpoofs,
yeah,
and I. No, I would go and visit my then-girlfriend, now wife, who was going to college at Bryn Mawr, so I had to make my way via commuter rails and subways,
yeah,
because I couldn't afford the Amtrak to get out to Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
And one of the tricks was to take the train to Grand Central Station from New Haven, then go down one on the subway, cross over on the shuttle to Penn Station, then get at the New Jersey Transit. And
where was Bryn Mawr? Was that New Jersey?
No, it's in outside of Philadelphia.
Oh,
you would,
okay,
take New Jersey Transit to Philly, 30th Street Station in Philadelphia.
Man,
yeah,
that's a trek.
And then you would take the SEPTA train out to Bryn Mawr.
So Penn Station was probably pretty scary.
Penn Station was – it was very – I mean, it was very scary. And I remember going through there once late at night. And it's surreal because I've walked through this underground passageway,
yeah,
from the subway to the train to the commuter train platforms, mm-hmm, many, many times since then. And it's obviously bright and clean, and there's a, you know, artisanal shoe shining, and,
yeah, Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like and a rap store or whatever.
Right.
That's not right. Not, you know what I mean?
Sure.
I'm not talking about guys selling raps.
Yeah.
Also, let's not use rap store because I'm like, now I sound like it's 1998.
Uh-huh.
What would you find in this thing? Now it's nice and clean and well lit.
Uh-huh.
And there's like an artisanal coffee roasters there.
Right.
But at the time, it was flickering fluorescent lights, 2 a.m., and homeless men and women sleeping in, you know, throughout the passageway.
Yeah.
Like all one by one next to each other. And it was upsetting and sad and terrifying to wander through.
Yeah.
And now we wonder where all those people went. The cleaning up of New York came with a cost.
Yeah, I mean, I've started going to New York in like 1994, and even then, Times Square still had the peep shows.
Sure.
And it was before the broom came through.
Yeah, exactly.
In a big way.
The Giuliani broom.
Yeah, but it wasn't like, you know, I've seen the pictures of the 80s and 70s New York.
No, and, you know, so another movie from that era would have been like Panic at Needle Park.
Yeah.
Which was like, you know, every green space on the Upper West Side was just full of people with needles in their arms. And it wasn't untrue.
Isn't it crazy that New York got that bad? Like a place that's so expensive and Tony that it was really
such a story
that let
history.
Itself go that much.
Yeah, but that was what was happening throughout culture in the throughout American culture in the 60s and the 70s,
yeah,
which is white flight. With some exceptions, you know, all the white people were going out to the suburbs,
yeah,
and through mismanagement and financial catastrophe and national economic catastrophe,
yeah,
New York went bankrupt and it was just a mess.
It's crazy,
I know, but that, you know, all the artists came in and
right.
punk rock. It was a vibrant time.
Uh-huh.
It's the time that everyone in New York wants to go back to instead of Manhattan being this weird Disneyland for European tourists and billionaire money launderers.
New York is a weird place. It's definitely strange when people are like, it was so much better and it was shitty and dangerous.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing as everything. America was never great. It was great in some ways, horrible in other ways, great for some people, horrible for other people.
Are you saying we're not making America great again?
Well, there's no point. We don't want to go back to whatever was determined as greatness before.
Yeah.
America has always been about aspiring to a certain greatness. But
yeah.
I digress. I'm talking about Escape from New York.
Right.
The idea that New York at some point
– you could buy it because it was sort of looking that way anyway.
Yeah. At some point in the near future, the government would just be like, there's no point.
Yeah, just put
there's
up
no
some
point.
Fences.
Just put. Let's turn it into a prison.
Yeah.
Let's turn it into a maximum security.
That's such a fucking great
no
idea
law
for a movie,
prison.
Though. You know.
Yeah. And it may like now you look back and it's like that would never happen. But at the time, it did seem like the natural extrapolation of what was going on in New York. Eventually, you'd get the last like Rockefeller biddies out of their white brick apartment
buildings.
Yeah,
the guardian angels would lay down their berets.
Yeah, that's
for
right.
good.
We give it up.
Yeah.
Isaac Hayes, Harry Dean Stanton, here are the keys.
Uh-huh.
That was
forgot Isaac Hayes, yeah.
That was Isaac Hayes, I think.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And Harry Dean Stanton, of course, was in it.
Yeah. And
Donald Pleasance.
And Adrienne Barbeau. Who, I mean, we're the same age. Who didn't have a big crush on her when you were 12?
I still do. I think she's
– Probably so. <Yeah. laughs> I haven't seen Swamp Thing in a while.
But Chuck Bryant.
Yeah.
Now New York holds a different sway over our imaginations.
Yeah.
And we're here to talk about one of the great New York movies that was filmed in Cleveland and Albuquerque, Marvel's The Avengers.
Well, yeah, but before that
– Oh.
Before we get to that.
Okay.
I want to hear a little bit about your – because I think anyone who listens to your shows or reads your books know that you worked in a movie theater.
Yes.
So we always here at Movie Crush like to start out with a little background.
Okay.
It was obviously a huge thing because you don't go and work in a movie theater unless you want to see movies for free.
Or you might really love popcorn.
Yeah.
Or
was that it?
Dealing with crazy people. I'm from Brookline, Massachusetts. I am 46 years old.
Yeah.
Which means that I still worked. I was able to work at the Coolidge Corner Movie House when it was called the Coolidge Corner Movie House. Now it's called the Coolidge Corner Theater. It's still a great movie theater. But at the time I was growing up in the and sort of coming of age in the 80s,
yeah,
Boston was a hub. They call it the hub. But Boston was a hub for independent cinema and art independent movie houses.
Okay.
And art cinema houses. And so you had not only the Coolidge, but you also had the Orson Welles. You had the Janus.
Uh-huh.
You had the Brattle Theater, which I think is still going. You had the Hole in the Wall Theater in Central Square, if I remember correctly.
Uh-huh.
The Nickelodeon Theater, right by the entrance to the Turnpike, had 5 or 6 screens that was showing international movies,
wow,
art movies, everything else. It was a really, you know, a wonderful time to go and see a whole bunch of movies.
And the Coolidge was close to your home.
The Coolidge was relatively close to my home. I mean, when I was in my early teens, I lived kind of in the western, much more suburban part of Brookline, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So my home theater was the General Cinemas Theater, mm-hmm, right near the Chestnut Hill Mall.
Okay.
But even then, you were going to see a bunch of, like, I mean, I think it's just the difference of the times. But I remember going to see a movie called Comfort and Joy, a Scottish dark comedy called Comfort and Joy there.
I think I've heard of that.
A famous movie maker whom I can't remember right now, but a local hero.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I think may have been the same director now that I think,
uh-huh,
of it, yeah. They had, you know, because at that time, the movie rental biz was just beginning to,
right,
catch hold.
Yeah.
So the movies were there for everybody. You had movies for kids. You had, uh-huh, movies for teenagers. You had movies for grown-ups going on grown-up dates.
Right.
And they were all being shown, even in the big chain cinemas.
Yeah.
So the General Cinemas was my jam. That's where I saw Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
That's where I saw the first R-rated movie I ever saw, George Orwell's 1984.
Okay.
I got stories to go with both of those if you need them. But then I also would go into Coolidge Corner, which is in the more cosmopolitan urban part of Brookline. And the Coolidge had two screens.
Mm-hmm.
One had been rescued. It was a very old sort of movie palace that once had a balcony.
Yeah.
And the balcony, sometime in before I turned 10, I would say, was converted into a second cinema.
Oh.
And they showed only repertory. So you would get a big – every week there would be a big mimeographed sheet of all the movies that they were going to show.
Uh-huh.
And it would be double features, different double features every night and, wow, a different matinee every day.
So great.
So it would be – and I remember going to see like a double feature of Ivanhoe and Robin Hood,
uh-huh,
on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
They did a lot of Marx Brothers. They did a lot of obviously classic film noir.
Uh-huh.
They did tons of samurai movies.
Yeah.
I saw Yojimbo there for the first time. I think I saw Seven Samurai there for the first time.
Now, was this while you were working there? You saw most of
these? No, this is all before I
right,
worked there. It was my dream job of all dream jobs.
Uh-huh.
And I applied. It was not a particularly rigorous application process, to my surprise.
Yeah.
When I turned about 17, I kind of went in there. I said, do you have any jobs? They're like, get going. Here you go. Here's a hokey cat. Go sweep up the carpet.
Uh-huh. And you went, do you mean it?
Yeah. I said, really, sir? And by that time, it had transformed. It was still independent. I mean, it was still owned by this one guy, Justin Freed, who had owned it for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole repertory thing had calmed down, and it was doing runs of foreign films and indie films.
Right.
Longer runs and also some second run Hollywood, like, you know, Hollywood stuff.
Right.
Things were – by that time it was 1988, 89 and there was a big video store, a great video store called Video Smith across the street.
Uh-huh.
And the idea that you would go to the movies to see an old movie was starting to drop off.
Right.
So I remember big long runs of like a French film called Le Souffle au Cœur,
uh-huh,
Murmur of the Heart. Long run of a movie called Chocolat.
Oh, sure.
What was another one? We did the big remastered re-release of Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh yeah.
And one of the projectionists there were two projectionists. Well, three really.
How old were those dudes?
It's funny, you know, because I was, you know, I worked there when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, like, mm-hmm, that. It was my last job when I was in high school, and then I would come back and work summers,
yeah,
and breaks when,
yeah,
I was,
sure,
coming home from college. And I would imagine they couldn't have been 30. You know what
I
mean?
But
they
old.
Seemed like real grown-ups.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Maybe they were 30, 31.
Yeah.
And it was a really amazing group of people for the most part. I mean, it was a group of like weird teenagers like me.
Film lovers, all I imagine.
All film lovers.
Yeah.
And then people in their, as I say, their mid-20s to their mid-30s who were also film lovers. And, you know, this was a time, you know, they were going to art school or they were aspiring filmmakers or they were,
yeah,
you know, not really sure what they were doing in their lives.
Right.
And those old, those slightly older people, you know, really were I felt like I was hanging around with the coolest older siblings I've ever met in my life.
I never worked in a theater. I worked at a great video store in college.
Yeah. Great job, too.
Yeah. It was one of those things where if you're going to make minimum wage somewhere, then it beats working at a gas station.
Right. I was just saying I'm right now on book tour for my book Vacation Land, available now at all bricks and mortar stores and online. Someone asked me about my favorite job. I'm like, I mean, the Coolidge was my favorite job.
Yeah.
But second favorite with a, you know, just inches behind was working at Film Fest Video in New Haven.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where you meet. I mean, that's where I got my great film education was in college because
right.
the dudes there said, oh, you don't know who Jim Jarmusch is.
You
don't remember. And, you know, they sent me like I thought it was cool because I like Spike Lee. They're like, oh, no, man. You gotta dive deep.
You have know nothing.
Right. Yeah, it was sort of like that.
You know nothing, Chuck Bryant. Yeah. I will show you.
But they did teach me a lot.
Yeah. I loved working in the movie theater more than working in the movie store.
Mm-hmm.
Working in the movie store was amazing because I love working in the movie theater more than working in the movie store because the movie theater was still theater.
Yeah.
Like, there was still, especially at the Coolidge, there were new shows.
Uh-huh.
There was definitely a Muppet Show vibe of like, it's time to start the music. It's
right.
time to light the lights. There were big rushes. People would come in. You'd be working real hard.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of the night, you felt depleted and like you wanted to shoot something over the street.
It's like a restaurant
butter
rush.
Pump. Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, a movie store, it's retail. People are wandering in and out and everything
else. It's a
lazy
job. Let's face it.
But yeah, believe me, I'm lazy.
Yeah. Same here.
And all you just watch movies all day long.
Yeah.
And the great thing about working in a video store, because you couldn't watch movies in the movie theater necessarily.
Right.
The great thing about working in the video store was that you had nothing but time to fill with bad movies.
Yeah.
Or you had nothing but time to fill with movies, so you had permission to watch bad movies. Also, you were probably, you know, in your late teens or 20s when you thought you were immortal anyway, so why not waste time watching terrible movies?
Yeah.
But there's a certain education you get from watching not just like famously bad movies, but just middle-of-the-road, mediocre rom-coms
that
and
aren't
junk.
Funny bad or cool bad.
Yeah, but it's just
they're
like
– not good.
Yeah, you learn, oh, that's who – you know, eventually you're like, oh, that's Bill Pullman. He was in that.
Right.
You know? There's Xander Berkeley. Right. I remember him from what's it called? Virginia Madsen horror movie. Virginia Madsen horror movie. Very famous.
Last Exit to Brooklyn.
No.
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
This is a movie. You know, this is a movie. You know, it's a horror movie. Candyman.
Oh yeah, sure.
With and the African American man who played Candyman.
Yeah.
Famous genre actor, Tony.
I mean, I can picture his face.
Tony Todd. Thank you very much. Good pull there.
Nice one, Noel.
Yeah. Where were you when I needed Louis Malle? Come on, dude. He should be doing that. You should have him on the IMDb throughout this whole thing.
Oh, just like fact checking?
Feeding us references.
Refs?
Yeah, feeding us refs.
But my brother worked at he was a general manager for AMC for a while and like ran theaters and open theaters. So he would always get me, and I think this is college and post college, but he would get us the sneak previews.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally, and it was during that time where he was like, hey man, there's this new movie called American Beauty and it's the buzz is good. Haven't heard of it. And so he'd screen American Beauty and Magnolia was another one that I hadn't heard of. You know, I knew Boogie Nights, but
yeah.
And then he got us into Star Wars early, you know, of course they were the bad ones.
Oh, the prequels.
Yeah. But we didn't know that at the time, you know, all the excitement around that first one.
We got to do that a couple of times too.
Uh-huh.
We got to see Slacker.
One Love
afternoon. It was it was great. It was an amazing experience, but you know, the legendary story, and obviously I wasn't there for that, but was they got Empire. And before anyone else did.
Wow.
And they did a private screening of Empire, and they didn't know what they were in for.
Yeah.
And they got what they got was Empire Strikes Back.
Uh-huh.
Can you imagine being one of the first people in the world to see Empire Strikes Back?
Yeah.
Come That's on.
Pretty neat.
That's amazing. But I'm not saying like just what that would – not like isn't that awesome that they got to do that? But like what that would feel like.
Yeah.
Be walking around.
Having this knowledge.
Having seen Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
And no one else had.
Yeah. My friend in elementary school is a very – you know how you have these memories that just are lodged forever?
Yes.
I remember in elementary school, one of my friends saw a sneak preview of Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him coming to lunch the next day, and it was literally one of these things where he was like, guys, we have – like this is serious shit.
Yeah.
We got to talk. He's like, I saw this movie last night. It was called Raiders of the Lost Ark. And there was a big boulder, and there were spiders, and there were snakes, and there was this dude with the whip. And it was literally like that for an hour. And all of us were like, I've never heard of any movie like this in my life.
I remember when Raiders came out, and it was the same kind of whisper campaign.
Uh-huh.
Where it was I remember Peter Rosenmeier saying to me, there is not a moment where it is not exciting. Like, it is just constant excitement.
Yeah.
And everyone was talking about it. It was a completely different kind of movie experience because even the movies that it was based on,
right?
Those old adventure serials, those things were only like those were short subjects, you know.
Well, yeah, but
you'd
it
get
was
them
certainly
for like 20 minutes, and then
it was nothing like anyone our age,
no,
in the '80s had seen anything like that.
No, even Star Wars, which came before it, you still had a moment where Luke's going to go look at those two sons for a while and feel bad.
Right.
There was nothing like that in Raiders. It was like, boom, keep it going. And that's what those serials were like. But, of course, they were only 20 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
And if you were to run them all together, you'd be exhausted. And that's what I think George Lucas realized. Like, let's just tire them out.
Right. Yeah.
It's amazing.
So, all right. We're getting to the Avengers now because – we got to talk about this, and we only have so much time.
Right.
It's tough to name your favorite movie.
Yes.
And you kind of refuse to. You're just like, hey, I got a bunch of movies. Jerk.
Well, we all do.
So let me just name one that I want to go watch right now, and I can watch again and again.
Here's my criteria. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of movies that have been my favorites.
Everyone does, of course.
And looking forward to having a conversation with my friend Chuck. I had two criteria that I established to pick the one that I would talk about. One, what is the movie that I would watch again right now?
Mm-hmm.
Just be honest with myself.
Mm-hmm.
Would I watch it again right now if I could? Two, what is a movie I don't have to watch again before I see Chuck because I don't have time?
to brush up on.
That I know because I'm on book tour for my book Vacation Land.
Yeah.
True Stories from Painful Beaches.
Available now.
Published from Viking Books.
Brick and mortar stores
and online booksellers right now.
Yeah.
And the one that I settled on, and you guys may have heard some of my teases of this earlier in the podcast, is Marvel's The Avengers. And it's important to me that we refer to it by its proper name.
Marvel's The Avengers.
Marvel's The Avengers.
Yeah.
Because that speaks to what is both beautiful and terrible about this movie.
Well, I watched it again this morning.
Yeah.
Because I always brush up right before.
Sure.
And I had forgotten,
how much
I fucking loved that movie the first time I saw it in the theater. And this is jumping ahead to the end. We'll kind of go through bits of it all throughout.
Well,
but
I was concerned that you were going to be one of these – or I'm not concerned, but looking forward to you being one of these spoil sports saying, that was a terrible movie. It had no third act, which is true.
No, the third act is the best part.
All right, let's talk about Marvel's The Avengers.
Yeah.
You go, Chet.
Well, I just forgot how much in the theater, how kind of over – and I wasn't a comic book – this is kind of embarrassing. I read Archie and Richie Rich.
That's not embarrassing
at all.
Stuff
like that.
Yeah.
I don't know why I never got into superhero comics.
Very wholesome.
I know. You know, my upbringing.
It was not my – I was not into those things, but my son is really into Archie.
That's sweet.
It speaks to people on some level that isn't me, but I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, I didn't read the superhero comics much. Every now and again I would get one.
Right.
But I wasn't one of these who knew all this stuff. But I still found myself in the Avengers in that third act. They finally come together as the Avengers, feeling this sense of thrill like a kid.
Yeah.
When they finally are all six on that overpass or whatever,
right,
in New York,
right,
and that's kind of, and that kind of hit home today. That's what the whole movie is. It's that moment of bringing everyone together finally.
Yes,
because I'd kind of forgotten now that I've seen Age of Ultron and all of the movies in the Marvel universe,
right,
that a lot of this movie, they're not getting along. They don't like each other. They're just getting to know one another.
Right.
And I kind of forgot that until I watched it again.
And Joss Whedon, I read a quote by him talking about trying to, you know, there had been a draft of the script written.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at it and he said, no, I want to start over. And he wanted to start over again. And he didn't really click into what made it work until he realized that none of these people should be together at all.
Right.
And it's not as though he invented that idea.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the original lineup of the Avengers was Iron Man, mm-hmm. Thor, and the Hulk, plus Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Right. And they were originally going to be in this, right? But he just thought it was too many people, I think.
Yeah. I mean, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, and there hadn't been an Ant-Man movie yet, and they didn't want to do that, is what I read.
Yeah. I think that the idea that Ant-Man was going to be in it was not really seriously considered. And mm-hmm. Joss Whedon, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but the idea that they were even making Ant-Man is a very small, no joke intended,
right.
Very small part of Marvel
mm-hmm.
world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was no real confidence that that was going to be a character that was going to resonate. You didn't have to have Ant-Man in
right.
the Avengers. The Avengers big three had always been Iron Man, Thor, and then Captain America once they unfroze him from ice
right.
in the comics. But the original lineup was let's set Ant-Man in the – well, the original lineup, as I say, was Iron Man, Thor, the mm-hmm. Hulk – Ant-Man and the Wasp. And the reason for that, arbitrary.
Yeah.
The publisher of Marvel Comics wanted something to compete with the Justice League.
Right.
So they – those very early days in Marvel, and they're like, what are our best-selling characters in their individual comics? Now let's mash them all up into a team.
Uh-huh.
There's no reason that they would ever be a team. The Hulk,
right.
The Hulk is a monster.
Right.
Like, it made no sense. And I gathered from this quote that Joss Whedon sort of – keyed into that and realized what is a group of people who don't fit together necessarily, but
right.
have to work together. What is that? And it's a family.
Yeah.
And it's about them becoming a family.
Yeah, and who you know, don't even like each other in
some
cases.
Don't even necessarily like each other.
It's like Steve
exactly.
Rogers and Tony Stark
yes.
are not two guys that would like one another.
Exactly so.
In real
and
life.
The way that's played in the movie is done so deftly.
I mean, totally agree.
They're, you know, and the performances are all stellar, and especially discovering the relationship between Tony Stark and Bruce Banner as scientists.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I had a feeling in the theater that I'm getting now that I will say was – I've had not been rivaled that just sort of sheer what the heck is this excitement
uh-huh.
since maybe Raiders,
yeah.
honestly. And you know, it's not as artfully constructed. I mean, it's a beautifully scripted movie.
Yeah.
Avengers is. But it does have that third act, which is essentially a roller coaster.
Yeah.
That doesn't quite mirror the beautiful construction of the Raiders screenplay by Lawrence Kasdan.
Right.
Which is just artful at every moment.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the stars of the movie are captured during the climax.
Like, yeah.
Like not, they don't even see the climax of the movie happening. Never mind. You know, they'll never be allowed to happen today.
Yeah.
The Harrison Ford of the movie would be imprisoned during
yeah.
the final moment of the film. Do you
yeah,
know
that's
what I mean?
True.
But that's its own thing. Do you
uh-huh.
know what I mean? Avengers was the product of such enormous, mm-hmm. it was such an expensive endeavor. So much in you know, Marvel Studios and Paramount and then Disney had invested so much money
mm-hmm.
into building each of these characters in their own franchises,
yeah.
which itself was a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
And then would it all work if you put all of these weird characters, this
uh-huh.
loner technocrat, this frozen in ice time traveler dude.
Right,
this
do-gooder.
This magic god and this monster.
Uh-huh.
And then these two, this man and this woman who you've barely seen in these movies.
Yeah, they were like, in Thor, I think, right? Wouldn't isn't that where
Hawkeye
they were introduced?
Hawkeye had debuted in Thor
uh-huh.
very, very quietly.
Right.
And Black Widow was in Iron Man 2,
okay.
I think. Yeah. But that they would all – that, you know, that you could find a script that would bring them all together and that the chemistry would work.
Yeah.
It was a huge gamble, and I think that it's amazing that it worked. And it's all, I think, because Joss Whedon appreciated, like, these people don't belong together. That's the story.
Yeah. I never got a sense that they took it for granted that, hey, we'll just throw all these superheroes in there and it'll be awesome just
right.
because they're all there.
Right.
Like, he really gave it a lot of thought. And all the – in fact, until the third act, almost every fight in the movie are between each other,
mm-hmm.
like the fist fights.
Yeah.
Like Thor fights Iron Man. Captain America kind of gets in there. Thor fights Hulk. Hawkeye fights.
Hawkeye fights them all because he's mind controlled.
Oh, yeah. Hawkeye and Black Widow fight each other when he's still under mind control.
Right. Exactly.
Hulk and Thor, Iron Man and Thor. They're all battling each other.
Yeah. Well,
but there are great fight scenes too, though.
And they're great fight scenes, that may not have been in Richie Rich, but the team
is definitely in Archie.
The superheroes who team up and fight each other first before they come together to fight the join forces against the bigger evil is a very common.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, it taps into that this is a family squabble
uh-huh.
before they can get together.
Yeah,
they needed something to avenge.
Yeah, and the name kind of hit home to me that's why they're called the Avengers. I know that's kind of
that name was randomly chosen
was
for
it?
The comic book. I mean, this is the other thing that's interesting about the movie, right? Because it's now that Marvel owns movies, mm-hmm. basically, it's hard to recall that when Marvel Studios formed mm-hmm. to make Iron Man with Jon Favreau in 2008.
Yeah, such a good first movie.
But they were left with the dregs of their IP, basically. Their premier characters, with the exception of the Hulk, but even the Hulk wasn't part of the deal.
Uh-huh.
The Hulk was Paramount. They got to use the Hulk in the Avengers
because yeah.
they made a deal with Paramount early on to distribute.
Well, and they had misfired, or not Marvel, but a few of those.
Right.
Who's Eric Bana?
Eric Bana in the Ang Lee version.
Yeah, which yeah.
I was a very disturbing movie.
Yeah. And then the Ed Norton one's okay.
Only movie where I ever yelled at someone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you want to know why?
Yelled on the at the screen?
I yelled at someone in the theater.
Oh, wow.
I hulked out in
What'd
the theater.
You do?
I went to see this comic book movie
uh-huh.
made by an incredible director
yeah.
that I thought I was going to really love and appreciate. And
yeah.
I got very confused because you have this basic story. It is Jekyll and Hyde.
Uh-huh.
A man unleashes the monster within him and cannot control it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. That's a great story. But there was layered into this version, I guess something that had come later in the comics long after I had stopped reading comics, which was that, in fact, Bruce Banner had been abused as a child.
Oh, right.
And that somehow psychologically enabled the Hulk to start forming. Then the gamma radiation brought that out or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot
about
that.
They're always writing that kind of stuff to make it interesting in comics. But
uh-huh.
it's like if you're making the movie, let's start with the basic story. Dude gets in this case gets bombarded with gamma radiation or swallows
yeah.
a pill, experiments with science, goes farther than he should and he turns into a monster. That's good enough. It's a good enough story,
yeah.
right? But they did. They brought in Nick Nolte to be the abusive
yeah,
father.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that now.
And I was like, this is terrible. This is – like kids are going to – like I'm sorry. I appreciate that you want to make them take – I of all people appreciate that you want to take comic books seriously
uh-huh.
and make them into a movie worth making and you not think they're just for kids. But guess what? They're also for kids.
Right.
They always will be for kids.
Yeah.
And I think like this – I just remember thinking to myself, this movie has a lot more like toddler torture scenes in it.
Uh-huh.
I was getting very upset. I was also a new father at the time, so it was
right.
really hard to take. And it was an early showing on one of the first days. I was there with my friend Darren Strauss, the novelist. I'm just going to plug his
sure.
latest
Go
memoir,
ahead.
Half a Life. And there were some people there with little kids. Now,
mm-hmm.
not just kids who I would feel bad for because they were being traumatized, but like – 2-year-olds.
Yeah.
And they were screaming and crying and they were just – it just would go on and on. Like they just didn't stop screaming or crying. And finally I got up and I said, take your children out of the theater. This movie isn't for kids.
Did they?
No. And really? Someone else told me, you're being a – shut up. You're being a monster.
Really?
And I was. I turned into the monster. And I was – the Hulk within me was unleashed. And
very
I was
metaphorical.
It took me a long time to bring him back in.
Wow.
My trick, Chuck, is I'm always angry.
Well, that's one of the best lines.
One of the greatest lines in movies.
It is. It's – and I had that written down, one of the best lines. And there are like three moments there in the end that I'm always angry line – right afterward when Captain America, when Cap has got the plan, you do this, you fly up there, you do this.
And Hulk,
smash.
Yeah.
Fucking great. And then the best moment of the entire movie, and one that I genuinely screamed with laughter again on my couch today, was when Hulk goes up there and faces off with Loki.
Yeah, puny god.
Loki calls him a dull creature.
Yeah.
And he just...
Boom, boom, boom,
the way he did it, like he went so ragdoll, the way Joss Whedon like pulled that off.
Yeah.
It could not have been more satisfying as a moviegoer.
It was fantastic. And as I say, you know, none of it had to work. None of it had to work at all.
Yeah.
And when they made Iron Man in 2008, mm-hmm. as I was saying, they were left with the dregs of their intellectual property. Because
like what?
X-Men, which was the biggest comic book of all time.
Uh-huh.
Was and is still owned by Fox.
Oh, right.
Marvel Comics in the early 90s was facing bankruptcy.
Uh-huh.
And they sold off their movie rights in order to stay solvent.
Oh, okay.
So that's why Spider-Man was with Sony.
Right.
Columbia Pictures. That's why X-Men and Fantastic Four were with Fox.
So the actual Marvel stuff, they just didn't own much.
It was just
end.
What they were left with.
Oh.
And the Avengers as a comic book was a big comic book. And these are, you know, Captain America is a big character and Thor is a big character. But they were never the marquee characters in the Marvel Universe, which were Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, and the X-Men, which were the biggest money-making in comics of all time and I think maybe even still. And the fact that the X-Men movie worked was this like, oh, what did we do? Like why did we let this go?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And what are we going to do? We got – Iron Man. Like I'm a Marvel guy.
Right.
And I read those comics. Mm-hmm. It's like if there was only Iron Man left at the comic book shop.
Yeah, I remember Iron Man wasn't like the biggest deal in the world.
It's like, ugh. You know, this kind of second-rate Batman.
Yeah, they made them all of those much bigger now through these movies.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And Captain America was always this total square. Mm-hmm. Like I liked him and I liked Mike Zeck's pencils in his mid-80s run.
Yeah.
Thor I could never really get behind because I love Jack Kirby, but Jack Kirby's fascination with pantheons of gods,
right,
which he would do over and over again in his career.
Yeah.
Kirby was the illustrator.
Didn't resonate.
I knew Norse mythology a little bit, but it's like a god really? And he looked dumb with his hair and his wings and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And the Avengers became, you know, as I mentioned, they were just sort of like, these are our biggest – it was almost like making the movie mirrored the making of the comic. It's like, we got to do this.
Yeah.
Who do we have?
Right.
Iron Man, Thor, the Hulk. This is what we got.
Yeah.
Throw them together. Make them a team. And over the years, it became part of the lore of the Avengers that the lineup was constantly changing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was usually some variation of Thor, Captain America, and Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
But then they would leave and then Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch would come in.
Oh, right.
All these sort of secondary weird characters that weren't really big enough to merit a title of their own.
They just throw them into the Avengers for a little while.
You're familiar with Wonder Man?
Was there one?
Of course.
No.
Simon Williams, Wonder Man.
Really?
Yeah. He was a very early Avengers. He was briefly an Avenger, or I think he was an Avengers villain who turned good, became an Avenger, then was killed. And that was a big thing that a character died.
Right.
And then he eventually came back in a very convoluted way. And Wonder Man was – he was almost as strong as Thor.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was his power. His eyes were red and they lit up, so he had to wear red sunglasses all the time. But he wasn't like Cyclops who could shoot lasers.
Right.
And – he had the great – in the 80s, he had jetpacks on either – on his belt so he could fly with jetpacks on his belt. He had like
– sort of an Iron Man
jet
thing.
Thrust coming down his thighs. That's right. How he flew. But in the 80s, you got to check this out. Everybody check out Wonder Man Safari Jacket because Wonder Man had the greatest superhero outfit of all time. For a while he wore this ugly green and red outfit.
And then they just said,
let's just totally redesign, let's rethink what a superhero costume should be. And he just wore like black tights,
yeah,
a blue turtleneck, and over it a red safari jacket with a belt. And that was it.
Wow.
And it was like, I was like, wow, I never thought that could be a – that's a costume. Uh-huh. It was like he went to Banana Republic one day,
yeah.
The old Banana Republic.
Yeah, when it was safari stuff.
Yeah, he was just sort of like a cat. He was like a guy you would see in a Cutty Sark ad on the back of Omni magazine in the 70s. Like, he wasn't wearing a mask or anything. It was really innovative. But it's considered to be a joke now, but it was really innovative at the time.
So that would be like at Comic-Con, there is someone that cosplays that out of irony?
I don't know.
Irony.
I would – yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's an iconically unusual costume. Uh-huh. But that's so, you know, that they built out of these characters. It was, you know, it was what was left to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, look, it doesn't give me great pleasure to applaud some of the largest corporations in the world for their innovation. But Marvel Studios, Kevin, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, Kevin Feige or Kevin Feige, mm-hmm. whatever, please put me in a movie, Kevin.
Yeah.
Come on. By now.
Sure.
Right.
To play Wonder Man.
No, I want to play MODOK. That's a very special character.
I've heard you talk about that.
Very special character. Please don't. I know that you will probably cast Patton Oswalt. It's probably a better idea. But please, please think of John Hodgman for MODOK, please. Mental organism designed only for killing. That's a side note. But it's clear they worked very thoughtfully to introduce these moderately known characters to audiences and then give them a reason to come together.
Yeah.
And again, it was like it was a tremendous gamble that it would work, and that it worked not only obviously financially successfully, but I think artistically so successfully.
Yeah, I mean, those movies were like, even for a guy like me that was not the big comic book guy, like I love the Iron Man movie.
Yeah.
I love those Captain America movies.
Oh, my God. Christopher Evans.
The Thor movie was meh. The first one wasn't
great. Chris Hemsworth is so lovable.
Yeah.
And like, I can't wait to see Thor Ragnarok.
I've heard it's good.
Because I feel like they've finally honed in on the inherent goofiness of Thor.
Yeah.
It was always there in Thor. I didn't see the Dark World.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Lean into your brand. Thor is this big doofus.
Right.
Big lovable doofus.
Yeah.
That's great.
He's got good one-liners.
Yeah.
But by the time Avengers rolled around, I was all in on all these characters because of those movies.
Right,
because of the way they did it.
Right. And Chris Evans, like, you know, Captain America to me
was always kind of
the square dude.
Uh-huh. He's so
Chris Evans made me care about that character so hard.
Yeah.
And as much as Robert Downey Jr. deserves, you know, credit for really invigorating this idea of Iron Man and just stealing every scene that he's in, that pairing of Chris Evans, his straightness and his decency.
Yeah, a truly virtuous dude.
Yeah. And it didn't feel like they always refer to – even in the comics, he's like a Boy Scout. He's not like a Boy Scout. This guy saw war and he knows what it's about.
Right.
And playing that in the scene where, you know, he's confronting Robert Downey Jr. saying, you know, what I've known men who are worth 1,000 of you or whatever it is, you know, who died. They didn't have a suit.
Right.
You know, put on the suit.
Yeah.
And that he never understood the meaning of sacrifice or losing a soldier, basically.
Right. And
which
he said,
what,
we're not soldiers.
Right. And that's what motivates the incredible sacrifice at the end.
Yeah.
It's a beautifully – that at least emotionally, it's as well constructed as any screenplay I've ever seen.
Yeah. And they didn't appreciate it that they didn't – that moment where he was flying the nuclear warhead up through the Tesseract hole.
Right.
They didn't overdo it with a sappiness. Like, you just had the one line of Captain America saying, you know, this is a one-way trip. And that was kind of it.
Yeah.
They didn't, like, pour the syrup all over it.
No.
You knew what was going on.
Absolutely.
And you also, let's be honest, you also knew he wasn't going to die.
Well.
Well, actually, maybe, because they had already done the Iron Man movie. So
yeah, you could have.
That could have been an end.
You could have seen a situation where RDJ wanted out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's a good point.
But I think he was locked in for some more movies at that point, so we knew. And no one wants to see him. I mean, that's the thing.
No.
These guys, this is it, I think. I mean, it's amazing to think. And I don't want to sell this like some – well, you know what? I think it's a great it's a great piece of culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they did was what we who read comics in the 70s and 80s thought could never be done. It's what we most enjoyed about comics, especially Marvel comics,
yeah,
in the 70s and 80s, was that these characters shared a world.
Mm-hmm.
And they shared a continuity. And it was short enough within our lifespan that we could age with them and things could change and the changes would show in the characters.
Right.
And that only can last for about, you know, 20 years, mm-hmm. let's say. You know, 75, 85 to 95. For me, those were my – that was my generation of reading comics. And that the share – the idea that you could have four, five, six, however many huge budget – pictures
mm-hmm.
that all share a world together and all affect each other in that way was so far beyond what we would imagine. That's what we loved about comics.
Yeah.
And that's what makes these movies so special. And with – I think with – basically they're saying or starting to hint or prepare us for the fact that after Avengers Infinity War 2,
right.
that's the end and they're going to start over again.
With new people.
Sure. And why not? I mean, look at Spider-Man
yeah.
Homecoming.
Yeah. Great like, movie.
Great movie. Great. And
best one since Spider-Man 2 original.
Yeah. I mean, these are characters that you know, that they're not written in stone. They're meant to be
yeah.
recreated and reinvented and so forth. So, and here's the only thing, last thing I'm going to say about it, that it's on my mental docket for uh-huh. the Avengers. The other thing that Joss Whedon did or whoever it was who clued into this, I'm not sure how conscious they were when they were doing it, but mm-hmm. it's very apparent now. It's part of what makes it so great is that the Avengers began as a knockoff of Justice League
right.
way back when.
Yeah.
Not a knockoff, but trying to catch that same energy,
uh-huh.
create a team. By the time the Avengers came out, the DC universe of movies
was a world of shit. Yeah.
And, you know, Wonder Woman I thought was great. I really enjoyed Wonder Woman.
Loved it.
Not a perfect movie.
Uh-huh.
None of these are. They can't be because
yeah.
of the money involved and the decision making and everything else. But, I mean, it was pretty – I mean, just a beautiful
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I loved. But there had been attempts to make a Justice League movie in the mm-hmm. 06, 07. It just didn't come together. And someone realized like, oh, guess what? Captain America, Superman, and Iron Man's Batman.
Yeah,
let's play that dynamic.
Right.
Wealthy playboy, orphan,
uh-huh.
who's got a bunch of toys.
Yeah, selfish.
Versus the embodiment of the American spirit.
Yep.
Who's a super good guy.
Uh huh.
And I don't remember that ever being a part of the comics. It may have been of the Avengers comics.
Right.
But it definitely was a part of the DC comic universe
mm-hmm.
going back to 1986 when Frank Miller wrote The Dark Knight Returns.
Right.
It was very – that is the comic that became Batman versus Superman, where it became this debate between America and apple pie versus mm-hmm. doing what needs to be done to protect innocent people or whatever.
Right.
So I thought that was like, oh, guess what? You made a secret Justice League movie too.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty awesome.
Much better too.
Yeah.
All right. So we finish up with two short segments here on Movie Crush.
Ba-ba-boo, two short segments.
One called What Ebert Said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
The great Roger Ebert, I always like to read a bit of what his review of the movie. He gave this movie 3 stars. And after reading the review, it was sort of a generous 3 stars because he didn't seem like he enjoyed it very much.
Yeah.
To be honest. But this is toward the end for him.
Well, you're saying that he was impaired?
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying that this is the newest movie that's been on Movie Crush, so I didn't even know if Ebert was around at the time.
I met Roger Ebert.
Oh, really?
It was amazing.
That's
he
great.
He couldn't speak at that time, but he signed my book. And,
that's awesome.
He had, you know, he could communicate Stephen Hawking style.
Right. Did you see the documentary?
It's so good. I have not seen it, no.
Oh, it's great.
2 stars. I'll take that, Roger Ebert, giving my Avengers 3 stars.
So he says this at the end of his review. Comic-Con nerds will have multiple orgasms, predicts critic David Edelstein in New York Magazine, confirming something I had vaguely suspected about them. If he is correct, it's time for desperately needed movies to re-educate nerds in the joys of sex. The Avengers is done well by Joss Whedon with style and energy. It provides its fans with exactly what they desire. Whether it is exactly what they deserve is arguable.
Obviously, Roger Ebert is an amazing person.
Mm-hmm.
and an extremely thoughtful and tasteful and an extremely great writer and a man of extremely good taste. But he got it wrong.
Agreed.
He got it wrong. You don't get them all right.
He didn't like A Clockwork Orange either. I did that one the other day.
Yeah, but you know, that's the thing. It's like, you know, the people write movie reviews. They've seen them one time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're seeing five movies a week.
Yeah.
Something hits you the wrong way.
Sure.
For whatever reason. And you go on record saying nerds don't have sex.
Right.
Frankly.
That's the job.
Frankly, that's pejorative. That's offensive to me. And I with great loving memory to Roger Ebert.
I give him one finger up.
No, not at all. I don't say that, but I would bet Republic credits, a number of Republic credits, that Roger Ebert would revisit that movie and think differently about it now.
All right.
Marvel's The Avengers, I mean.
And then finally, five questions with John Hodgman.
Yes.
Number one, first movie you remember seeing in the movie theater.
You know what? I am going to go with, just because I was thinking about it, I feel like maybe Born Free.
Oh, okay.
But one of the earliest movies I saw in the movie theater was at the Coolidge,
mm-hmm.
before the balcony had been turned into a second movie theater. I was under 10 for sure, and my babysitter Missy took me to see Annie Hall.
Oh,
yeah, and there was a scene where he sneezes all the cocaine away.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, what was that stuff? She said, I'll tell you later.
And you went home and blasted some rails with your babysitter.
I think she is just one of those things where she's like, I got to do something with this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
This little guy. What am I going to do?
That's funny.
But maybe he'll fall asleep to this.
Well, this is perfect. Second question. First R-rated movie, because you teased it earlier with a story.
If I remember correctly. The first R-rated movie I saw was 1984, starring John Hurt.
Yeah.
And
pretty intense movie for a kid.
Richard Burton.
Yeah.
Well, I was 13. I was in prime affectation mode.
Uh-huh.
I had read 1984, and you know, we were all thinking, you know, that was prime reading of 1984 time.
Right.
And the movie had come out, and I was not one to break the rules to go see an R-rated movie, but. Mm. On the other hand, this was famous world literature. So,
right.
Yeah. Have you seen that movie?
I don't think so.
It's worth seeing.
Yeah?
It's really well directed, incredibly well acted.
In fact, I know I haven't.
Horribly disturbing. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, it gets it.
Right.
And the fact that they made it at all, like if it didn't happen to be 1984, if it didn't happen to be the year 1984, no one would have thought to make a movie of 1984.
Right.
Because it's just so terrible and depressing.
Uh-huh.
And they leaned into the depression.
That's great. So it was released in 84 as well?
Yeah, that was the whole thing.
Gotcha.
With music by the Eurythmics.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's great.
Get the kids in.
All right. Number three, do you walk out of a bad movie and do you remember doing so recently or at all?
I don't remember ever walking out of a movie ever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. All right. If I'm in a movie theater, I like it.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the experience of being in a movie theater. I can't remember being – the only thing that would do it would be being offended.
Right.
But I've not been offended in that way.
Okay. Number four, can you name a guilty pleasure or do you have one?
Movie-wise?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't, but.
I don't feel guilty about any of my pleasures.
Okay.
I can't think of anything.
All right.
It's like I don't have 20 viewings of The Cable Guy under my belt that I got to cop to.
Number five, finally.
No offense to The Cable Guy, by the way. I mean.
Sure.
Ben Stiller directed that movie, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to work again in Hollywood. Ben, you did a great job.
It was a good movie.
Yeah. It was
ahead of its time, I think.
I think I agree with you. I think I didn't get it because it was ahead of its time when it came out. And Jim Carrey was doing some weird stuff in that movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're really sucking up to Ben Stiller right now.
I want to work.
And number five, finally, John Hodgman. Movie Going 101.
Author of Vacation Land.
Movie Going 101. What's your movie rituals? Where do you sit? What do you get at the concession stand?
Oh,
I find that most people kind of have a thing that they do.
So generally speaking, old school going to movies.
Mm-hmm.
Popcorn with butter.
Okay.
Diet Coke.
All right.
I used to like to go close to the front. Now I find that painful.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a closer up rather than further away person.
Okay.
And I like to get there early and get seats that I like rather than – and sit around rather than, you know, get there late and have to sit way in the back like when I went to go see Battle of the Sexes.
Right.
It's a good movie, by the way.
Oh, is that out already?
In New York City it is.
Well, maybe down here we're going to get it by Oscar season.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah,
that
I want to see
that. Tennis movie.
Was it good?
It was great.
All right.
Emma Stone is fantastic in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Carell is great in it. And everyone's great in it. But now I will say this. My going to the movies is an infrequent ritual.
Yeah.
Because why? I don't have time. Mm-hmm. And most things I can see on my home.
Right.
Screens. But if I'm going to the movies, it's most likely because a big movie is coming out that I want to see.
Right.
It's usually some kind of visual fantasia.
Like a Blade Runner, even though you haven't seen that
even
yet.
Though I would have. I happen to be on book tour for my book Vacation Land, which is available now, johnhodgman.com or bit.ly/painfulbeaches. You can come see me on tour. When is this coming out?
Kind of whenever you want to. Like, I can slot you in there.
All right.
Earlier than later.
When I do, so I like, even though I live in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
I still like to go to the I think it's now an AMC Lincoln Square. It used to be Sony Lincoln Square. It was Lowe's Lincoln
Square.
Oh,
you go into the big city?
I go into the big city.
Yeah.
Atop of there, it's a huge complex, and on top of it is a massive IMAX theater,
mm-hmm.
and it's assigned seating. So I never have to worry about it.
That's the best.
Yeah. So I'll go make a day of it and go in and see Marvel's The Avengers
right.
or something similar. I'm looking very much forward to my local movie theater, which was called The Pavilion. It's now being renovated by the Nighthawk Theater Group in Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah?
And that's going to be a reserved seating, eat some French fries in your seat kind of place. When that opens up, I think I'll see a lot more movies.
Yeah.
And by the way, listeners in Austin, Texas, November 18th, I'm going to perform the one-man show that my book Vacation Land is based on for the first and last time in Texas. Chuck, you were there when I performed the show Vacation Land here in Atlanta.
That's right.
It's a good show, right? It's a good
great.
One-man comedy show.
It is really, really great.
And I haven't been performing it because I wrote a book based on it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to go back. I never performed it in Austin, so I'm going to go perform
fun.
In Austin on November 18th.
Where were you at there?
The Paramount Theater.
Yeah, that we were just there.
Yeah. Tickets are available. Go to johnhodgman.com/tour if you'd like to come and see me. And I'll be selling books and signing those books or anything else you want to bring or foist into my face. I'll be there all night long talking to you if you want to come.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you so much. I like talking about movies with you.
We should do it again.
Okay.
That was fun. That's exactly how I thought it would go, actually, which is us goofing around and talking about a lot of stuff and a little bit about the Avengers, which is pretty much what I expected. So big thanks to John for coming in. Go out and buy his book, Vacation Land. Go out and listen to Judge John Hodgman, his fantastic show that I'm have been a litigant on. I've been a guest witness on. And one day I hope to be a guest bailiff when Jesse can't make it. And so I'll complete the Judge John Hodgman trifecta. Great, great show. I'm a big fan of that one still. Listen every week on the Max Fun Network. And, just follow John on Twitter. He is at Hodgman, H-O-D-G-M-A-N. Funny Twitter stuff. His great Instagram. He's got a fun Tumblr with a lifestyle newsletter that he puts out every week. He's easy to find. So support the man. He supports us. And I hope you enjoyed it. Until next week on Movie Crush, why don't you give the Netflix a rest and get yourself to a theater for a change? Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.